Hello, fans and friends of the Accents podcast on WUKY. I'm your host, Katerina Stoikova, and this episode has been brought to you by Accents Publishing, an independent press for brilliant voices. My guest today is poet and teacher Shauna Morgan with her new poetry book, Ground Provisions. Hi, Shauna. Welcome to Accents.
Hi, Katerina. Thank you so much for having me.
Congratulations on this gorgeous book.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
The book is organized in three parts. Please speak about the organization of the book.
Sure. Yes. So, the book really sort of at the heart of it deals with my journey, multiple journeys, physical journey, emotional journeys, and it even sort of generational journeys. And the first part of the book really deals with my Jamaican, is really centered on my Jamaican experience, sort of pre-immigrant, but also there's a kind of reaching back, also some, nostalgia for Jamaica, for a past. The second part really focuses on the kind of new immigrant US experience, but then also kind of deals with kind of maturing, growing into, relationships, motherhood, but particularly in the US space. And the third part of the book is really sort of looking ahead. It's anchored in Kentucky. It deals with sort of the connections I'm making, between my Kentucky life and my Jamaican life. And it's sort of in many ways too, sort of forward looking, and centers on sort of being more grounded in place and self.
I noticed quite a bit of code switching, especially at the beginning.
In terms of
Just,
language.
yeah, in terms of languages. So, was it risky, natural, or both?
It's very natural, I will say that. It's very natural for me to occupy a space where I'm code switching on multiple levels, right? Whether in the US experience as a Black woman, in this space, or even sort of in terms of my language, my Jamaican Creole or Patois, and yeah, so it's very natural, but in terms of my writing, I mean, it comes natural, but I understand that there are risks, when I sort of when this manifests on the page in all the way it does.
I tend to do that too, with Bulgarian in my poems, and I tend to do that with conversations with other fellow immigrants, and we speak our own language because that's the context of our daily life, and that makes a lot of sense. And if nothing else, poetry is supposed to reflect our experiences. So I really enjoyed seeing the different words and the different letters. And I thought that I definitely want to talk to you about it.
Yeah, sure. There are poems that include Jamaican Creole very explicitly. There are poems that kind of uses the syntax of the Creole, even without the Creole words. And then there, is Caribbean Hindustani in here, and yeah, Sanskritic texts and, so yeah, it's really representative of my identity as a person from the Caribbean, as an Afro-Indo-Jamaican person. And yeah, all of that, like you said, exists in my daily life, and is very much a part of my creative work.
Tell us about the sense of belonging versus the feeling of being out of place in a culture. And then maybe you can read a poem about it if you want.
Sure. I've always said I can make a home anywhere. Transience is kind of a way of being for me, having emigrated and moved, so many times and across continents and what have you. But there is always with that a sense of being out of place, even as I feel like I can live anywhere, I can make a home anywhere, a sense of being other, different, even moving through the landscape of a place, right, can sort of make you feel or become aware of your distinction from that place, right? When I go back to Jamaica, there is a distinct sense of home there, and the way that it sounds, the way that it smells, the way that my, feet feel on the earth. But also, recognizing that every place changes, and there's something really interesting to me about how we change, how the landscape of a place changes. And so I guess that's a really kind of long way of saying that I feel that the sense of belonging and the sense of being out of place is fluid in itself. There are moments where I feel as if I belong to Kentucky, as if this is my place, this is my home. And there are other times I feel distinctly the opposite of that. And even going back to Jamaica, that sense of home is there. But it's also very different from the Jamaica that I lived in many years ago. And so there are moments even then where I feel outside of place. And that interests me a lot. I don't think there's that's a clear answer, but I find it very interesting and fascinating, that tug and pull, and the way we shift as much as, place does.
You know, I have found out that moving has costs, has a lot of benefits, and if I have to make a choice, I'll do it again every time. But there is cost to it. And what you said, that it's complicated and fluid, yeah, that's what makes it so interesting to explore in poems. Would you like to read us something?
Sure. I'll read a poem that I don't think I've ever really read anywhere aloud, other than to myself. But it's I think tries to get at that. This is called Carry On Items. The familiar hum of cabin air and pleasantries steward me to the row of unmoving faces, all carry on items below the seat, and I ponder the placement, store all items in the bin on my head, Aji laughter, granny feet clapping tile, the smell of a sweaty head of silver hair coming in from the coop finally to cook. It's not masala today. No alu and chana, Dettol, urine, blood. I am iron. I carry on far away from frail legs and mapped hands, knuckles pushing against new old skin. This poem has kind of transitions at multiple levels in it. It is at once about literally moving on an airplane, literally going on an airplane and carrying myself across the sea, right? But it also is about carrying memories, about where you put these things that you have to hold, about loss, about death, about history and generations transitioning through death. It's about mourning.
And yes, and your work explores ecosystems of multi-ethnic Black life with attention to the body, grief, identity, and freedom in the natural world. How is one able to achieve this in poems?
Well, I don't think I think I'm striving. I think that I'm always searching for that. Surely no one poem encompasses all that, although you can find traces of it in different poems. But it's really for me a matter of seeking that and trying to ask questions and figure out how language can evoke, the sort of gravity of all those things. Yeah, I think I'm still searching and striving.
Talking about striving and writing, and yes, you cannot put everything in one poem. That's why you write many. That's why you put them together in particular order. But I want to talk to you about editing because your poems sound and look perfect. How many drafts do you go through?
It depends, I'm grateful that with this book I've had the opportunity to go through many, many drafts, One of my poetry teachers said, this was Susan Mitchell. She said, you don't have to hold on to something just because it was there first. And taught me a really important lesson about revision, because I had been so inclined to hold on whatever it was that, that came out first. And other folks too have taught me quite a bit about revision, and I've learned so much. And there's something really beautiful about, putting something down on the page. And I always, sort of write in a flurry. And, it might look just like a list of words on the page, or, I don't think about stanza and line breaks much in the initial drafting. And then there will be the draft that gets then rewritten by hand and tries to take shape in some kind, tries to find its form, tries to find stanzas and line breaks and things like that. And then that sits for a while. And if I'm lucky, I get to come back to it soon, and read it out loud. The African American poetry critic, Lorenzo Thomas said a poem is not a poem unless until it's read out loud. So I will read it out loud to myself and try to feel what it's supposed to sound like, how it feels coming out of my mouth, and whether that looks like what it's supposed to on the page, and if it's having some kind of impact. So, I mean, gosh, at least three or four versions of a poem will exist, and then it gets really exciting to revise after that to see what a poem can become. There are quite a bit of sonnets in this collection, and I don't think I've ever fancied myself as a person who writes sonnets, but there is something about the form that just kept on coming to me. And so the summer that I really sat down with this collection, I kept saying, oh my goodness, this poem is turning into a sonnet. Oh, another one is turning into a sonnet. And it was exhilarating to sort of see what the poem could then become, something new, something that, just that revision process is exciting. So yeah, I don't know if that answers the question.
Well, you also have not only quite a few of sonnets, but you also have a Sistina. Anybody who writes a Sistina has my eternal admiration, and you have high buns in the book. How do you find time to write?
That is the perennial question. I don't find the time to write. I guess I'm compelled. I mean, I'm always writing in my head, right? I'm always writing in my head. I'm always scribbling on scraps. I was really fortunate to, when I got to Kentucky, join a writing circle, writing what is nurtured and led and created by Tanya Torp and LaTanya Jones. And really, in that circle of women and that space was really what kept me writing and sort of unloading all of those things from my head and soul onto the page. And so a writing community has been really critical for me, just and so necessary. I'm not in the circle now, but I'm still trying to scribble some things. But I find when I'm in community with others, I tend to produce more, more, sort of consistently.
Is writing poetry more difficult when you teach creative writing, asking for a friend?
No, not for me, because I am the kind of teacher that also works along with my students, whether I'm giving like a workshop, a one-off workshop on, one-time workshop in the weekend, or if it's throughout the semester with my students, I'll often, say, I'm gonna, here's the prompt and I'm going to write draft with you. And so I always do that. I don't always go back to it right away like they do, when they have to revise and so on. But I always try to take the opportunity if there is some kind of prompt or if there is a writing activity, even if I'm facilitating it, I will try to write along, even a little bit. But to sort of take your question a little bit further, I would say that the kind of work that I did to get this book together, just focusing every single day for an entire month on nothing else but this collection, is something that I can't do, when I am, grading or doing administrative tasks. It really requires my brain to do something very different. So yeah, I mean, there are challenges, I can draft something or jot something down, but it's very difficult to get to creating some finished work, when I'm really focused on my pedagogical work, or if I'm even like trying to do something different, like write a critical piece or something like that.
Would you mind reading to us several poems from the book, some of your favorites?
Sure, I would love to. You mentioned a high bun earlier, so I think I'm gonna read a high bun commendation of the dead. This is from the first part of the book. Commendation of the dead. Following the body towards the altar, in pace with his other children, sisters she never knew, and the brother who had been her playmate in primary school. She waited to look upon his rigid face, picture of stillness, like the parent image framed on her mother's mantle. When the word came with prayers of remembrance, a fulsome edification on his charming life, kindness immeasurable, devotion unceasing, the paragon of a doting father. It wounded more than she could bear, a cross of redemption hurled at her body. The worshippers raised songs, a fervent ensemble extolling him before the committal. She accepted every hand. Announcements that she was the outside child who favored him had his eyes, a pity she returned only after he died. The aunts remembered a sweet, obedient child. The uncles embraced her with full arms and chests, had dreamed of her womanhood when she was still a girl, chided her absence, asked after her mother, said they knew her well. First and last rites raise a wintering family to warm cerement. And that's actually a poem I wrote with one of my graduate classes, drafted it anyway with them. I am going to read another something like a grief, I guess another poem that rests in the space of grief and lament, also in the first part of the book. This is Away Like Dust. I have come to understand a feeling. Her body lurching, bending forward, eyebrows knitting a query to the mirror. She has become a weeping mother, calm in the public stretch of night, watching the mourners, the revelers, the plates of curry and rice, Manish water cups steaming, their butterfly wing handles floating by. In the pale periwinkle of dawn, our ram goat wakes to fight the rope at his neck, bleating, which way today? She runs through the yard, disturbing the heap of swept-up leaves, grabbing her belly, tearing at her clothes, the skirt tails of lost children brushing her legs until she rips them away, rolling in the dirt, dignity away like dust, earth to ashes, a wood stove white with exhaustion. A moan bellows from her. She has become the stock of animals we keep, hoofing the dirt, bucking and braying. Imgan, Imgan, woy, 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 Imgan. I have favorites, and then I have the ones that I often read. So, I don't always read my favorites. I think in the readings that I've done, over the last few months, or even as this book was coming to me, are always poems that I feel like an audience might respond to, but those aren't necessarily my favorites.
Oh yeah, I realize that. Yeah. It is very special sometimes to want to share the ones that are your favorites or to read upon request something that you've never read out loud.
Yeah, I think I'll read one of the earlier, maybe the second poem, Grafted. And this poem has a song that my grandfather used to sing. And it's really about the kind of coming together of cultures that I grew up with, with my dad being Indo-Caribbean, my mother Afro-Caribbean, and the way those, crash beautifully into each other sometimes. And so the script here, engrafted, it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, ikdo, ikteen, char, panch. And so that is the Hindi text, as well as a song in Caribbean Hindustani. Grafted, ik. Four paths to Denby Drive, a narrow way to the yard where white ringed trees and mangoes stand guard. Bombay on the left, East Indian on the right, the Bahari and Chinarasulu forming a new fruit, cleaving flavors for the elder son who had grafted his own tree, springing heavy branches, a motley of impossible tones and textures. Doi. Beyond the pink house, its barred windows, its iron seats, after all this time, a breadfruit hangs, yellow heart, so sweet, still here, having never worked off its time. Past the old lime, branches alive with a blanket of black caterpillars crowded on each other's backs. A patch of grass holds the avocado pear tree, roots turned sideways, branches and fruit lying down where we wept a loud and sad release, a mournful bhajan. Teen. Krishna ko sang. O to bala kuchar kaucharavan pangaya. Krishna ko sang. O to bala kuchar kaucharavan. A song in my grandfather's lessons. My ashen, not as brown skin. Bare feet spun, stamped the ground, hands and wrists twisted this way and that, broadened his infrequent smile like my ek doitin jar panch. Jar. I never saw his fading face, only heard the deathbed song, a weak, hollowed-out thing, a Bhojpuri dirge, lyrical and long, for the hummingbirds who flitted from trumpet flower to hibiscus. Their wings in harmony with my giggles, leaving as swiftly as I did when the smell of sweet, crispy gulgula and jalebi welcomed me in for prasad and puja. Punch. An image of him riding his mule through caned field heat sits next to a glass, its tray, The oil I use to rub his feet. The murti hangs above his holy Bible, its pages marked by tasha paper, remnants from the last Hussein he built. His gun and hat sit restless atop the wardrobe. I pull his fine comb and scissors, see one of my many faces in him. Krishna ko sang utubalaku gaucharavan pangaya. I didn't realize that poem would get me. It just like completely transformed me, like transferred me rather to my grandparents' yard with the mango trees and the breadfruit and all the flowers. And I'm thinking about that a lot right now as the Hurricane Melissa is bearing down on Jamaica. And it's goodness. Yeah. My middle name is also Melissa. It's very strange. But I'm just, yeah, my heart is there always, but especially right now.
I was going to ask, what does the M stand for? And Shana M. Morgan, and now the secret is out.
Fortunately or unfortunately, Melissa, and it's sort of, and it's so in in Jamaica, a lot of people have what they call yard names, which is like not the name that's on your birth certificate, but what everybody calls you. Sometimes it's your middle name, sometimes it's a name that occurs nowhere on legal documents, right? And
Could be a
so
nickname.
just a name that you've been dubbed, but my mother's always called me Melissa, and so it's, before now, there's been a lot of amusement around it, but right now we're very worried.
I love the voice in those poems. Immersive, sensual, delicate, yet grounded. Would you like to read us one more poem? Then I have more questions.
Sure. I'll read another poem from the first section. Holly Lizard Tales. The transparent belly bulges brown, revealing the last twitches of once flies. Wiggling a diversion, the red tail releases, the body scurries away. My grown fingers remember a pointer holding the dancing tail, too, if I was lucky. A gathering near the moist black soil below the ginger lily, its flowers an upspray of crimson. A holy breeze blowing the Norfolk pine and the bougainvilleas, thorns wrapped and bowing to the gully. A congregation of begonias along the burglar bars, filled with the spirit and shaking like broken away tales. The disappearing form. Like memories, like childhood, like a home.
These are amazing, Shana. The book was published in England. Yes, tell us about People Tree Press.
Peepal Tree Press is the home of Caribbean and Black British literature, well, fiction, poetry, literary criticism, memoirs, historical studies. Kwame Dawes has said that, and I'll paraphrase probably poorly, but that their status, or stature as, the most distinct publisher of Caribbean poetry is unassailable. And they're celebrating their 40th anniversary this year. I'm very excited I get to go to England and be a part of that. Reading the 40-year anniversary reading, but really a press that, it's an independent press that is led by founded and led by Jeremy Poynting, and just a really wonderful legacy of, publishing some of the, Caribbean writers who are, giants in Caribbean literature. And yeah, just a really, I'm real, I feel very grateful to be with this press. I've always read and taught books from this press, so it feels really special to be at home. with them. And I think much like you, an accent's just a press that's really focused on nurturing a writer in a particular way. So I'm grateful for that.
The book is beautifully produced. Tell us about the front cover.
This is very special to me. The cover is a painting by a young artist, actually, Ella Angeli Curlew, who went to Henry Clay High School here in Lexington, is a visual artist studying at Cornell University. And I talked with her about the collection and sort of the things that really were important to me and stood out to me. And she painted this and allowed me to use it. But in complete transparency, she is also my daughter. We worked with the press, she really did a great job in sort of coming up with some concepts and some early studies, and worked with the managing editor to find something in that.
First of all, I love that your daughter painted the cover. I think that's so special. That is so special. And another thing that I love is how there is food and offering in the middle.
Yes, I mean, that's really central to the book, right? The idea of, the title Ground Provisions. Ground provisions are what we refer to in the Caribbean, but also, in the American South, among Black communities in the American South. But in the Caribbean specifically, ground provisions are, foods like yams and sweet potatoes and, things that you dig from the earth and, but also like plantains and things like that. And so the ground provisions are significant. This is the connection that I was making between the American South. The ground provisions come from that plot or the provision ground that historically, enslaved people would, it's the space where they would resist, where they would grow their own food to sustain themselves, right? And so the provision ground, was a space where we would get these provisions. And so it is kind of a it is an offering, and it might be something received or something given in this instance when I'm looking at the piece of art, and there is dasheen, also known as taro, and Scotch bonnet peppers, and it's I liked the way that this painting really, I think offering is exactly the right word, that I think of. Again, one either given or received.
Well, the gesture in the painting itself, and our listener will have to look up the book and hopefully buy a copy, is I like the balance between nurturing of that offering and the openness of it, and yet offering the choice to take or not. So, such talented artist.
Yeah, she's incredible.
Speak about your connection to the earth and gardening.
Yes, I grew up in a very rural community in Jamaica, in Clarendon, and I grew up with people who always grew things. I mean, there was always a plot or a little provision ground in whatever space I lived. The earth is very important, culturally, historically, right? To be in community with that. I mean, my umbilical cord, or my navel string, as we say in Jamaica, was buried and plant was planted at the base of a cherry tree. So a young cherry tree was essentially planted on top of the place where my navel string was buried. It's something that represents our connection to the land, and that cherry tree is still there and hopefully will be there after, even after this hurricane. And I was always with people who grew things, right? Small farming community. And so I feel very much connected to the earth. I have a little provision ground in my yard, an urban garden. I am not myself if I'm not putting my hands in the dirt at some point, or walking through the woods or what have you, or growing something. The activist Jim Embry says, if you're eating something, you must be growing something. And I firmly believe that that we have a responsibility. But also, there is something sort of deeply spiritual for me about touching the earth, and not just helping to grow and nurture something that will eventually feed me, but it's a kind of communion, I guess, for me.
That's amazing to me that you've been rooted into the earth physically since birth through the navel spring. That is amazing and so symbolic. And then the connection to the earth. I wanted to share a practice that a friend of mine, poet Chris Mattingly, does. He's an avid gardener with very strong connection to the earth also. When he finishes a poem, he prints it out, goes into his backyard, and buries the poem.
Fascinating.
Yeah, and it's kind of like planting poems to harvest more poems, but also, dust to dust, right?
Yes, there's something deeply poignant about that.
What can one find at the intersection of art, music, and literature?
One can find oneself, truths, openness, beauty, pain, perspective. My goodness, I think that the answer to that is goes on and on and on, to infinity. So many possibilities. Yeah, this is central to who I am, and even who I am as a teacher. If I'm teaching a lit class, there will always be visual art, there will always be music. If I'm teaching a creative writing class, the same. And I think that there is a long, literary history legacy of that, and particularly among Black and African diaspora and folks, whether they're in the Caribbean, the United States, Europe, wherever, right? And on the continent, that art and music all have always sort of worked together. And writers and artists have always engaged with musicians. And so I think, some of the most incredible work, art being created right now, is obvious, is not done just sort of in, isolation in terms of genre or what have you. It's really collaborative, or reaches across, to touch other mediums.
And this is a question that I ask all my guests who teach creative writing. What is the most important thing you teach your students? If there is one thing you want them to remember from your class or workshop, what is it?
Thank you for that question. I'll have to ask myself that again and again. I think it's important, in terms of what I want to accomplish, but what I want them to leave with. I try to be a very intentional teacher. My priority is always creating a space, a community space in the classroom that where it's a climate where folks feel free to write, and an openness to kind of share with each other. This is I'm really thinking about this. I want them to understand the profound impact their art, the words that they put down on the page, can have on the lives of folks who they touch and on themselves. I want them to recognize just the beauty and power of that, and power not in the sense of kind of an overtaking power, but a kind of way that our writing, our work can cross borders, spiritual borders, physical borders, borders in terms of thought and ideology, and really touch people in amazing ways. I want them to realize the possibility of their work being able to do that.
I so gorgeously said, our work does not belong to us. And you don't know, you never know what's going to do and how far it's going to travel in space or in time.
Indeed.
Lastly, would you kindly read the poem In Abundance, the second to last poem in the book?
I would be happy to read that poem. This is another favorite poem that I have never really read anywhere other than to myself. In abundance, living on strong bush tea and the love of children who wrap their arms around waists, fingers almost touching. Swinging on hips that bore them into the world, the healer stands before the mirror, breasts like longy mangoes, thighs insolent, their dimples boasting what was learned, what was taught. Invocation, a warm laying on of hands, brewed fever grass, soursop leaf strained, head wrapped. Mama, did I drink from you? The daughter's grasp, as soft as the flesh and its memories. Yes, you and your twin sister. The healer smiles, sees her own naked mother illuminating skin and its scars, birthmarks and legacy lines, like Cerisy vining a fence. Like purslane and provisions from the ground, a yam mound, a past unearthing to future spreading in abundance. Thank you for asking me to read
Thank
that.
you for this magic, Shauna, and thank you for this conversation. I wish the best for you and your amazing family and this incredible book. I appreciate you.
Thank you so much, Katrina. Thank you for having me and for asking me these wonderful questions and for letting me share.